Thank you for listening to a reading presented by the Poetry Center of Chicago. The Poetry Center is an independent, nonprofit arts organization promoting poetry in Chicago through readings, workshops, and arts education. To learn more about the Poetry Center, to read poems by our students in Chicago Public Schools, or to donate, please visit www.poetrycenter.org.
Hi, thanks for braving the rain coming out. We delayed it a little bit so that people could get in. Thanks for coming to this evening's event to celebrate poetry and the poetry of Lucille Clifton. This reading, I'm going to start out with the important stuff, is underwritten by the Elizabeth F. Cheney Foundation and is co-sponsored by the Gwendolyn Brooks Foundation, Gwendolyn Brooks Center at Chicago State University. So can you please thank them for helping us with this event? My name is Kenneth Clark. I'm the executive director of the Poetry Center of Chicago, an organization that was established by poets 31 years ago, Chicago poets. The Poetry Center has presented through its reading series hundreds of the world's poets to the people of Chicago. This is one of several events in the 31st annual reading series, the last of which happens Friday, June 4th, and features poet Miller Williams and his daughter, the two-time Grammy Award-winning poet Lucinda Williams. It will be a performance, a benefit, and Miller will be leading a workshop for 15 people. And that's on June 5th. And the word's around that your workshop lasted 4 hours last night, so people had a great time. In addition to readings, broadsides, and workshops, the Poetry Center has a program called Hands-on Stanzas. It pays Chicago poets to be in residence in public schools for year-long residencies. We had 3,000 students regularly engaged once a week for 20 weeks. And then they also did special projects for the benefit of the Holt School, which reached out to about 17,000 students. A new anthology featuring about 1,700 poems, it's about that thick this year, will be published soon, and a copy will be given to each of the kids published in the book. That's our outreach program. I'd like to recognize and thank the Poetry Center's members, the volunteers, the board of directors, and the staff. There's three of us. And Poetry Center support comes from the Lannan Foundation, Target, Poetry Center members, the Illinois Arts Council, the Lloyd A. Fry Foundation, the Polk Brothers Foundation, the Boeing Company, the Chicago Community Trust, the MacArthur Fund for Arts and Culture at the Richard H. Driehaus Foundation, Verizon, Gaylord and Dorothy Donnelly Foundation, Allen and Lynn Turner, Bank One, the Elizabeth F. Cheney Foundation, LaSalle Bank, and there are some others as well. And that's the list. So without further ado, it's my pleasure to introduce Michael Anania. He's a Chicago poet. He's a longtime supporter of the Poetry Center, and he will introduce tonight's poet. Michael?
Well, some of the notable things in the Lucille Clifton list first. Her poetry has been published in numerous and distinguished collections, beginning with Good Times in 1969. The list includes An Ordinary Woman, Next, Good Woman, and Blessing the Boats, new and selected poems which came out in 2000. I'm especially fond of her memoir, Generations, which I think is an extraordinary act of prose memory. She's a wonderful writer for children as well. She's received the Shelley Prize, the Lannan Fellowship, NEA Fellowships, and this puts her in a short list among poets, an Emmy. She has been Poet Laureate of Maryland and is a Chancellor of the American Academy of the Academy of American Poets. Her voice, I think, is one of the clearest and most certain in American poetry, vivid in its account of experience, deft in its political sense, and absolutely dead certain in its evocation of myth and spirit, musically eased out among us as a plain, perfectly pitched song. There's much to hold on to in her work as consolation and anthem, as spirit song and self-discovery. In one passage from a work that I especially like, she says about the general condition of things in the world, things don't really fall apart, but are held together by thin lines that, if we're attentive, we can pick up, reconnect in serious ways, and pass around. the string theory, I guess, in its earlier incarnation. Did I get the quote wrong? Oh. I'm not quite sure when I first met Lucille Clifton. It was sometime in the early 60s. Her husband, Fred, and I were in classes together in graduate school in Buffalo. She was, as she says about that period, taking care of babies. I do, however, remember, as though it were yesterday, the first time I heard her give a public reading. It was at the Y in New York in 1969 at one of the Discovery programs. I have her voice in my head from that day on. I have the poems there. I tried to reconstruct the list of what you read, but I came pretty close. There were, as the evening was announced, discoveries that night, but Lucille was and still is a revelation. I'm delighted to present my friend, a good, certainly, but entirely extraordinary woman, Lucille Clifton.
Thank you very much. This is, I feel good, but I feel a bit nervous today because, now, I have known him over 40 years. That's too long. No, it's not too long. We were young once. I remember faintly. And tonight I met for the first time Michael Hayes, with whom I wrote a children's book. But we'd never met. I wrote the text and he illustrated. So I feel good about that. And imagine having Lee Young Lee in the room. Aren't we supposed to, like, fall to our knees or something? Imagine having all these poets and wonderful people. And imagine having Ken come up and do whatever the heck he's doing. I'll say anything, so deal with it. I'd like to read some older poems and some new poems, which is what everybody wants to do. So why is that unique? Somebody once said to me when I said what I do, they told me what I did. People do that. And I liked it. I embraced it as a motto type thing. And it was, like many preachers, I come to comfort the afflicted and to afflict the comfortable. You will know which category you fit into by how you feel, isn't that right? But I'd like to start with these times. This is a poem called The Times, and it is about when we live now. And also, I was reading the New York Times. I'm very bad at titles. I'm awful at titles. So actually, there's nothing cool about my titles. I was reading New York Times. Okay. The Times. It is hard to remain human on a day when birds perch weeping in the trees and the squirrel eyes do not look away, but the dog ones do in pity. Another child has killed a child, and I catch myself relieved that they are white. And I might understand, except that I am tired of understanding. If this alphabet could speak its own tongue, it would be all symbol, surely. The cat would hunch across the long table, and that would mean time is catching up. And the spindle fish would run to ground, and that would mean the end is coming. And the grains of dust would gather themselves along the streets and spell out, "These too are your children. This too is your child." I think about that nowadays when I look at the news. I next want to read a newer poem. I was looking through my work and I wanted I've forgotten what occasion it was for, but I wanted to find some poems that really celebrated landscape, you know? That's what American poets do, right? We like to talk about birds and stuff. And I am clearly convinced that everything is connected. I'm reminded of a poem I wrote when I was Poet Laureate of Maryland for a while, for some years, mostly because I think they forgot about me. But the only thing that I was asked to write was on Maryland's 350th anniversary. And the theme of the 350th anniversary in Maryland was our happy colonial days. And that's really hard for me. Having had maybe two, you know, a couple of Christmases maybe. Anyway, I was, so I did a four-line poem, which is simply, they ask me to remember, but they want me to remember their memories, and I keep on remembering mine. That's something to think about, too, when we look at the news and television. Anyway, I'm looking through my poems, thinking about, landscape. I must somewhere have praised some grass. I mean, I must have. And I couldn't find anything. And this actually was in Mississippi. I was reading at Ole Miss, which is something interesting in itself. And they were going to celebrate, they were going to do something for a woman whose five children, an African-American woman, five children had graduated from the University of Mississippi, obviously, recently. And they wanted to do a memorial for her, so they decided to plant a tree. Now, I have a quirky mind, but I thought, please don't plant a tree for the lady. I mean, trees, we have not loved trees. We have hung from them, and we didn't like that. You know, it wasn't fun or anything. So this poem is a result of that. Surely I am able to write poems celebrating grass, and how the blue in the sky can flow green or red, and the waters lean against the Chesapeake shore like a familiar. Poems about nature and landscape, surely. But whenever I begin, the trees wave their knotted branches, and why is there, under that poem, always an other poem? Remember about me reading, remembering my memories. This is the first time I have ever had some poems that I wanted to read. I've been very meditative today, and I'm worried about the world, you know? Are y'all worried about the world? The whole one. Not like in world literature where it stops at an ocean, but the whole world. And this is a poem called Sorrow Song. I haven't read it very often. For the eyes of the children, the last to melt, the last to vaporize. For the lingering eyes of the children staring, the eyes of the children of Buchenwald or Vietnam and Johannesburg. For the eyes of the children of Nagasaki, for the eyes of the children of Middle Passage, for Cherokee eyes, Ethiopian eyes, Russian eyes, American eyes, for all that remains of the children, their eyes, staring at us, amazed to see the extraordinary evil in ordinary men. I find it annoying to believe that somebody did some horrible stuff, but it's okay because they were just following orders. The Geneva Convention has something in it about one has the right to disobey. Isn't that right? Am I right about that? One can disobey. And see, nobody has to tell me you don't humiliate and degrade people. I already know that. Nobody has to tell me that. Do you know? I have a certain moral something or other. So if I wasn't taught that, why didn't I learn it? I tell people at schools that all the time. They don't teach me nothing. Well, why didn't you learn something? But that's a whole different question. I have a place in St. Mary's County, Maryland, which is very rural. We did sidewalks, and they had to redo them because they had the sidewalks are going like that. And the idea, we have to walk on that, so that was a whole new thing. Anyway, I've lived by Lake Erie, because I'm from Buffalo, New York, originally. But the Chesapeake Bay and the St. Mary's River, they're not landscapes that I've been that crazy about. And people talked all the time about the white caps. Do you know about white caps? No? Go find some water, and you see when it's kind of, I don't know if it's stormy, when it's just moving around a lot. You see this white, the tops of the things coming in. I described it so badly. Somebody out there, how many people know about white caps? Okay, tell somebody else as soon as we're over. As soon as this is over, turn to your fellow and tell them about that. And anyway, I forgot to say something, too, that I had meant to say. I borrowed this line from Cuba Gooding in the Fighting Temptations. If you are not expecting a call from Jesus, please turn off your cell phones. If you are expecting a call from Jesus, we all want to be in on it, so it's okay. But anyway, I looked at the people were talking about the white caps, and I looked at them one day, and what I saw was what looked like nappy white hair. You know, coming ashore. People marching ashore with nappy white hair. Now, you all know what nappy hair is? Some of you all know what nappy hair is. Some of you all may have forgotten, but you may touch my hair later. It is nappy. Anyway, I wanted to write about that. So this is called Wind on the St. Mary's River. It is the elders trying to return, sensing the coast is near and they will soon be home again. They have walked under two oceans and too many seas, the nap of their silver hair whipping as the wind sings out to them, this way, this way. And they come rising steadily, not swimming exactly, toward shore, toward redemption. But the wind dies down, and they sigh and still and descend, while we watch from our porches, not remembering their names, not calling out Jeremiah, Fannie Lou, Geronimo, but only white caps on the water. Look, white caps. My neighbors all now yell, the elders are coming. My neighbors are great. I'm very interested in the history of places, primarily because I'm very nosy. And we have Southern Maryland is a place that was that wanted to be in the Confederacy, but because it was during that war so close to D.C., they couldn't. They could not join the Confederacy and be safe. But they have Confederates in their hearts. And if you look up the history of African Americans in Southern Maryland, you don't find anything. And I get so concerned that if we do not tell our story, and I mean all of us Americans, they will be forgotten. And it will be forgotten, for instance, that we all helped to build this place. There is a plantation there called Mulberry Fields. And part of that plantation now is where the president of our college lives. And the story about Mulberry Fields is that there was a slave graveyard there. Did you ever wonder where slaves were buried? Somebody asked me, did they die? actually, yes. And they didn't keep them around, they buried them. And someone noticed that land was very good land, and so they took up the headstones and the footstones of those graves and tried to plow the land, but the land would not allow itself to be worked. So it's wild with wild flowers. The stones were kept in a barn because preservationists are interested in that sort of thing. What I noticed about preservationists are that they are interested in preserving the places, not the people. And I'm interested in the people. So some of the stones went to build a wall around the plantation, and some of the stones went to rebuild the state house in the first colony of the state of Maryland. And I wanted to write about that, and especially the fact that nothing grows where the slave graveyard was. Mulberry fields. They thought the field was wasting, and so they gathered the marker rocks and stones and piled them into a barn. They say that the rocks were shaped, some of them scratched with triangles and other forms. They must have been trying to invent some language, they say. The rocks went to build that wall there guarding the manor, and some few were used for the state house. Crops refused to grow. I say the stones marked an old tongue, and it was called eternity and pointed toward the river. I say that after that collection, no pillow in the big house dreamed. I say that somewhere under here molders one called Alice, whose great-grandson is old now too and refuses to talk about slavery. I say that at the master's table, only one plate is set for supper. I say no seed can flourish on this ground, once planted, then forsaken. Wild berries warm a field of bones. Bloom how you must, I say. I read that poem at St. Mary's College, and a woman there, a friend, said she was going to go talk to the guy who lives alone on the plantation because something didn't sound right. I hate to be checked up on because I'm very good at research. I tend to know what I'm talking about. And so she said, he said, that they weren't taken up for plowing. They were just taken up. He didn't seem to see. The point was the disrespect given those graves, you know. I don't care why he disrespected them. He just did. And then he said, and anyway, the people who lived here freed their slaves just like Thomas Jefferson freed his in the same year. And I suggested he check it out, since Thomas Jefferson did not free his slaves. He did free his children, which is interesting. Are you afflicted or or comfortable? Oh, well. I've had cancer 3 times. I've had 2 breast cancers and the renal cancer. And I had that after I had kidney failure, and I was on dialysis for a year, and then I had a kidney transplant. The 2 cancers at the same time were, that one was not a metastasis. I just had 2 different cancers. I figure only I would do that. You know, let's do it differently. Okay. And I won the National Book Award 1 year, and they wanted me to go and have the cancer seen about, but I was the chance to dress up, you know? I mean, I had 6 children, right? I had 6 children in 6.5 years, and I was not going to give up the chance to get dressed up for cancer. And so I told them, we have to delay this because I'm going to get the National Book Award. That's so sad. But anyway, this is called Cancer. The first time the dreaded word bangs against your eyes, so that you think you must have heard it, but what you know is that the room is twisting crimson on its hinge, and all the other people there are dolls watching from their dollhouse chairs. The second time you hear a swoosh, as if your heart has fallen down a well and shivers in the water there, trying to not drown. The third time, and you are so tired, and you nod your head and smile and walk away from the angel uniforms, the blood machines, and you enter the nearest movie house and stand in the last aisle, staring at the screen with your living eyes. I think that what's interesting is that that for some people, poets are supposed to talk to them about things that are pretty, you know, and supposed to make them feel that things are all pretty. Well, I think there is great beauty, but pretty and beauty are not the same thing. Most beautiful women, if you ask them, let's trade and you can be pretty for a while, they won't go for it. Pretty women would give a lot to be beautiful. In our family, which is interesting, my oldest sister was a prostitute. Now, you know how in families you have labels? Like in our family, I was the smart one. Well, that's cool when you're like grown, but when I was like 12, the last thing I wanted to be was the smart one. You may have noticed boys don't like the smart one. Maybe it's different now, I don't know. Isn't that? We'll talk. I have one daughter who tells me it's not true anymore. Gee, I have one unmarried daughter. Anybody who knows a guy, late 30s, has a job, see me after the program. Anyway, my oldest sister, Josephine, was a prostitute for many years. She's no longer living. And she was interesting because while she was in prison quite often, and she would like study, and she got a GED, and then she got a BA, and she worked as secretary for the warden, and she did a lot of interesting positive things. I really feel something about when people talk as if human beings are not complex. You know how people are talking about the soldier female, how she couldn't have done so and so because she was nice. You know, a lot of nice people. Carolyn Forché has a line, there's no thing that one man will not do to another. The people who stood around in the photographs of lynchings, some of them were very nice, except four, you know. My sister Josie was very nice. She was very smart. And when my father was dying, she came home to take care of him. Anyway, this is a tribute to my sister. Here rests my sister Josephine, born July in 29 and dead these 15 years, who carried a book on every stroll. When Daddy was dying, she left the streets and moved back home to tend him. Her pimp came too, her diamond Dick, and they would take turns reading the Bible aloud through the house. When you poem this, and you will, she would say, remember the book of Job. Happy birthday and hope to you, Josephine, one of the East's most wanted. May heaven be filled with literate men. May they bed you with respect. I should say that my sister's pimp, Diamond Dick's name was not Richard. But Now here's something I bet you never thought about. I mean, I love movies. I really do. And I'm very tacky. People know that. I live with it. It's okay. I'm a poet, and I'm a distinguished professor at my college, so I'm not supposed to be tacky. I'm supposed to watch PBS all the time. And everybody knows it. I look at The Price is Right, people. Bob Barker is the only person there older than I am, and I'm going to look at The Price is Right, okay? On Saturday, my mother at one time worked in a welding factory, and my father, of course, worked. And we used to go on to the movies on Saturdays. My brother and I would go there, and that was our babysitter, really. And I used to love to go to see movies, especially I'm very fond of Godzilla. I am a Godzilla person. King Kong, Mothra. Do you know who Mothra is? They live in, three little girls, they live in boxes. They live in a little box and they sing, Mothra, Mothra. And for some reason, this huge moth comes flying in to rescue them. I love the Godzilla ones because the people always say, the people in Tokyo say, it's a monster. You know, like, I mean, wouldn't that be kind of startling? I mean, you wouldn't say it's a monster, another monster. Anyway, I loved those movies because I was an African-American girl. The monsters were not interested in Lucille. In fact, the monsters only liked white girls. Think about it. In fact, King Kong would knock a sister down to get to Fay Wray or Jessica Lange. He would. He did, actually. And so I used to wonder about that and wonder if anybody else noticed. Some of us did. But I was never afraid of them, you know. The only one I used to be afraid of was I was a little bit afraid of Frankenstein because he wasn't human exactly. And so maybe he didn't know you were only supposed to like white girls. I don't know. Trying to rationalize my life. Anyway, do you know who the Phantom was? Those of you who know who the Phantom is, later talk to somebody who doesn't know who the Phantom is. He was, they thought he was immortal, but it was carried down from father to son, being the Phantom was. There was a movie, starred Billy Zane. See the stuff I know, it's amazing. Ask me something that matters, I have no idea. Anyway, the Phantom. In his purple mask, his purple bodysuit, lived with a wolf called Devil. The village believed him immortal, the ghost who walks, though he was only a man. I would save up to go watch him in his cave of skulls, his penthouse in the city. He would fall in love with a white girl, like all the heroes and monsters did. I was a little brown girl. After the show, I would walk home wondering, what would he feel if he saw me? What is the color of his country? What is the color of mine? I did a reading in San Francisco one time, and someone said, if she would just forget about race. I don't think I'm gonna, you know, I really am not. And I'm not gonna let anybody else forget about it either. Not until it's all fixed. Not until it's all okay. I was thinking about that, where do you hear this? This is a real stretch. But I was thinking about that when I was thinking about the latest photographs and things that we have been seeing, too much in my opinion. Would that have happened had the enemy been Norwegian? Would it have happened had they been Swiss? Something to think about. Anyway, I'm also always interested in what happens after the event, you know? And by that I mean, okay, the prince found the shoe and it fit the woman, and they got married ever after. What happened after that? Did she go to the castle or palace and have lots of children? Did she buy a lot of shoes? Was she into shoes? Did he say you're buying too many shoes? I just wonder what happened. This is called After Oz. You know the Wizard of Oz. You know the story. Midnight. No, I should tell you this is in the voice of her aunt. Midnight, we slip into her room and fill her pockets with stones, so that she is weighted down, so that storms cannot move her. She disappears for hours, then staggers back, smelling of straw, of animal. Perhaps we have lost her. Perhaps home is no longer comfort, or comfort no longer home. Evenings, we sit awake in our disenchanted kitchen, listening to the dog whine, to Dorothy clicking her heels. Well, this is kind of a fun poem. I had a couple of aunts. They were kind of nutty. My grandmother was really out of it, I think. She thought I was 12 until she died. I was married, had children. And she would want me to behave, and what she always wanted me to keep my dress tail down, which I attempted to do. I really did. But one time when I was a girl, we were having a family barbecue type thing at my father's house, and my Aunt Blanche, my mother's youngest sister, rolled down the driveway into the street. Now, I did not say she rolled something down the driveway into the street. She rolled down the driveway into the street. I had never seen that. I was a girl. And when I asked somebody, why is she doing that? They said, oh, she's just jealous. So that's why, to this day, I am not a jealous person. I have never been a jealous type, because no way I'm rolling, you know, down a driveway. Anyway, this is called Praise Song. To my Aunt Blanche, who rolled from grass to driveway into the street one Sunday morning, I was 10. I had never seen a human woman hurl her basketball of a body into the traffic of the world. Praise to the drivers who stopped in time. Praise to the faith with which she rose after some moments, then slowly walked sighing back to her family. Praise to the arms which understood little or nothing of what it meant, but welcomed her in without judgment, accepting it all like children might, like God. My father was a factory worker. He worked at a company that was called Symington Gould's in Depew, New York, which is a town just outside Buffalo, and which is the reason I was born in Depew, New York. My brother and I were the black people born in Depew, New York. Somebody told me recently I got an award from Buffalo, in Buffalo, and somebody said, there are black people living in Depew. There's one right on the corner of, you know. I said, whoa, you know Depew, Michael. Trust me on this one. No way there was anybody else. And so when I was young, because Depew was a poet, did anybody know Depew at all? You're kidding. Oh, girl, we'll talk. Really? Well, I was born in Depew. And because Depew at that time was a Polish town, I understood Polish and I spoke Polish. And I worked for, I don't anymore, okay? I know, I could be bilingual. And I used to work for the Office of Unemployment Insurance in Buffalo near Sattler's, you know? And people at that time, I was quite young, I might have been 16. And people were really mean to people who got unemployment insurance. You may have noticed that. Somehow people who have middling power try to use it as much as possible. I always teach my kids to go to the top, because they have power, but they don't have to try to use it. Anyway, I was never mean to people, because at that time the largest amount you got on unemployment insurance was $50. And I know that's not a lot of money for a person with a family. And so people would come in, and almost the only English that they knew was, where's the colored Polish girl? And since I was the colored Polish girl, I would go out and help them, or what have you. Anyway, my father, his great regret when he worked in that plant was that he could never be a foreman, because at that time, no black person could be a foreman. But he used to train what he called the college boys who came in the plant to work. And he would be asked to train them to be foremen. Now, why anybody would think he wouldn't become annoyed about that? I don't understand why people, what's wrong with that? That's the way it was. It didn't have to be that way. Anyway, this is a poem called What I Think When I Ride the Train. Maybe my father made those couplers. His hands were hard and black and swollen, the knuckles like lugs or bolts in a rich man's box. He broke a bone each year as if on schedule. When I read about a wreck, how the cars buckle together or hang from the track in a chain but never separate, I think, see, there's my father. He was a chipper. He made the best damn couplers in the whole white world. When I first went to be checked, I never expected to have cancer. I mean, who expects to have cancer, you know? No one in my family ever had. And I was quite shocked. Though I didn't think I was going to die, I've had a lot of things, and I never think I'm going to die. I think about death a fair amount. I have two children in the last 5 years who have died. And I know I'm not going to die in a plane crash. You know how you know things? So when I get on, I'm always real tickled. I always feel like they're so lucky. I'm here, and I'm not dying in a plane crash. So they are so safe, you know. So if you see me on a plane, relax. It's okay. But when I went in, I thought, I really don't have this kind of time for cancer, you know. But anyway, the first time I had cancer, I had a lumpectomy, breast cancer. I had a lumpectomy. And this is a poem called Lumpectomy Eve. All night I dream of lips that nursed and nursed, and the lonely nipple lost in loss, and the need to feed that turns at last on itself, that will kill its body for its hunger's sake. All night I hear the whispering, the soft love calls you to this knife. For love, for love. All night it is the one breast comforting the other. Among the other things that I like to think about is I like things to be named for what they are, you know? I think our stereotype of Native American names is sort of like that. You know, Lucy, a little overweight, but still trying to make it. That would be my name. And I would do it in English so it couldn't be misinterpreted. As, for instance, the Native American person in history that we think of as young man afraid of his horses, whose name translates to young man who is so fierce even his horses fear him. That's very different. But we're very bad at translation in our culture. Anyway, I was reading about slave ships. And three of the slave ships, this was their name. One was called Angel. One was called Grace of God. And one was called Jesus. Now, that doesn't strike me as exactly right. Slave ships. Loaded like spoons into the belly of Jesus, where we lay for weeks, for months, in the sweat and stink of our own breathing. Jesus, why do you not protect us? Chained to the heart of the angel, where the prayers we never tell are hot and red as our bloody ankles. Jesus, angel, can these be men who vomit us out from ships called Jesus? Angel, grace of God, onto a heathen country. Jesus, angel, ever again can this tongue speak? Can these bones walk? Grace of God, can this sin live? I've been trying to figure out a way not to read a sequence of poems that I think I'm going to read. And that's because I'm a Cancer. I want everybody to like me, you know? And there are ones who will like me. I think again about the person saying that I should try to forget about race. I met a young man quite recently who said that he didn't know. This was at Duke, where we recently were reading, and he said he wasn't sure he was going to like me because he'd read my poems, and some of them were angry, so he didn't know how I'd be to be around. You know, I mean, when things are bad, you're supposed to get mad, right? Why is it that I have a poem that ends, and now we're still not beasts, but we're supposed to be saints? I'm a human woman. I get mad when stuff is rough. I'm angry with the world. I'm angry with the world for not understanding how complex humans are, for not facing up to what we are like and then trying to do better. You know? If I understand that, and I'm not even religious, people think I am, but I'm not. I don't understand, and I do know that it is depressing to think about these things. I understand that. I'm depressed. But I don't understand how, because I have my own memory, you know, and I remember in Buffalo when I had to go around and I couldn't try on a hat, for instance. I remember the first white person that said I could use her comb was a gym teacher. And we all looked at her like she was mad. I mean, doesn't she know that our hair will, like, come off or something? I don't know what we thought. It's so crazy. After 9/11, some poems came to me and I wrote them down. And I wanted to read them because it was a horrible thing. It was a horrible thing. And we were then trying to find out if other people had weapons of mass destruction. The only country on the planet that has ever used weapons of mass destruction is the United States of America. And we used them twice. Okay, Hiroshima, but Nagasaki? Because we wanted to test a firing device? Come on, people, humans with children. That makes me mad, too. Anyway, I had lost my second daughter, and my oldest daughter, 1 year and a week after my second daughter died, had a baby girl. And this was only interesting in that my daughter at the time was 43 years old. So she has children now, 21, 19, and 2. And of course the 2-year-old is rotten. She is so spoiled. And I continue to spoil her. I plan to do that all her life, as much as it is, I see. But I heard so many things after that incident. So many things that seem to mean that people don't remember what being human is like and about, especially if you're people who talk about morality, etc. You know, we have not ever taken responsibility for our own morality, just as I think African Americans have not taken responsibility for their own complexity. Anyway, these are poems written after that. If you're mad, it's okay. I have 2 sons-in-law. They're both white. And when I'm in a mood, they come around and, like, bring me coffee. For some reason, I feel that if she just had a little coffee, she might be all right. Decaf, right? Which is all right, you know. And actually, I'm rather fond of them both. They're good to my daughters. That's all I want. And one of them is the father of my granddaughter, and that's lovely. Tuesday, 9/11/01. Thunder and lightning, and our world is another place. No day will ever be the same, no blood untouched. They know this storm in other wheres, Israel, Ireland, Palestine. But God has blessed America, we sing. And God has blessed America to learn that no one is exempt. The world is one. All fear is one. All life, all death, all one. Two. Wednesday, 9/12. I should say that I was more interested in joining the war on terrorists, if the Ku Klux Klan was targeted. Two, Wednesday. This is not the time, I think, to note the terrorist inside, who threw the brick into the mosque. This is not the time to note the ones who cursed God's other name, the ones who threatened they would fill the streets with Arab children's blood. And this is not the time, I think, to ask, who is allowed to be American? America, all of us gathered under one flag, praying together safely, warmed by the single love of the many-tongued God. Friday, 9/14. Some of us know we have never felt safe. All of us, Americans, weeping as some of us have wept before. Is it treason to remember? What have we done to deserve such villainy? Nothing, we reassure ourselves. Nothing. Saturday, 9/15. I know a man who perished for his faith. Others called him infidel, chased him down, and beat him like a dog. After he died, the world was filled with miracles. People forgot he was a Jew and loved him. Who can know what is intended? Who can understand the gods? Sunday for Bailey. My granddaughter's name is Bailey, and she always reminds me, or so far, she's called on the anniversary of my second daughter's death, and she said, Grandma, don't be sad. Remember, my name is Bailey Frederica Clifton Goyne. And I said, I'm not sad now, and I do remember. Anyway, Sunday morning, 9/16, for Bailey. The St. Mary's River flows as if nothing has happened. I watch it with my coffee, afraid and sad as are we all. So many ones to hate, and I, cursed with long memory, cursed with a desire to understand, have never been good at hating. Now, this new granddaughter, born into a violent world as if nothing has happened, and I am consumed with love for all of it, the everydayness of bravery, of hate, of fear, of tragedy, of death and birth and hope, true as this river, and especially with love, Bailey Frederica Clifton Goyne, for you. That Monday, the week after, was Rosh Hashanah. Do you know what Rosh Hashanah is? There are people here who are Jewish. You know, this is so interesting. I've been to read places, and when I ask if people are Jewish, nobody will raise their hand. And then later they come back and say, I'm Jewish, I just didn't want to. I would, you know, some of my best friends are Jewish. It's really true. And, you know, they haven't had a great time either. Monday, sundown, 9/17, Rosh Hashanah. I bear witness to no thing more human than hate. I bear witness to no thing more human than love. Apples and honey, what is not lost is paradise. I'd like to recite, because I don't have it here, I think, one more poem. And then we have some minutes for questions. I love answering questions. And if you want to fuss, that's good. I like fussing, actually. And I'll answer whatever you ask. Try to explain it. Anyway, you're talking to a person who's in the last 4 years have lost, or I guess within the last 5 years, I have lost 2 children, a sister, a brother, a kidney, a parathyroid thing. I don't know what that was. They just took it out fine. You may have it. Put it with the others. All this stuff, you know. It's amazing when I think about it. And yet, I was teaching I was at St. Mary's College, and I keep my door open at college because I wish to be welcoming to students. I'm there for students. And they know if I'm there and the door's open, come on in. They know that. And they come in and fuss all kinds of ways, and I don't mind. But I overheard a colleague, and she came in, was in her office talking, and she cannot believe that I'm on the faculty. Plus, she can't believe that I'm a distinguished professor and that I have a chair. She just thinks that's just so awful. What is she doing here? She says that all the time. She's amazing. And at that time, I was very vulnerable, and my feelings were hurt. I am much less vulnerable now. I want you to know that. And anyway, when I heard her talking, I did this poem, which I'd like to read for. I'd like to read it for the Poetry Center, and I'd like to read it for the United States of America. Won't you celebrate with me what I have made into a kind of life? I had no model. Born in Babylon, both non-white and woman, what did I see to be except myself? I made it up here on this bridge between starshine and clay. My one hand holding tight my other hand. Come, celebrate with me that every day something has tried to kill me and has failed. Thank you very much.